The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
For joining us today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and as always, I'm wishing you the best. And we are so happy to bring you our show right here on Progressive Radio Network, Gary Knowles Network. And of course, you can listen live every Monday, 1 to 2 p.m., and you can join us anytime, 24/7 at progressiveradionetwork.com. Under Archives, The Natural Nurse. We are very happy to have as our guest today Dr. Anna Kellis. Dr. Kellis is the director of the School of Applied Clinical Nutrition at New York Chiropractic College, and she has dedicated her career to elucidating the connections between nutrition, human health, and the health of our environment. At Brigham University, she began her formal exploration into human and environmental health through a dual bachelor in biology and environmental studies. And she studied macrobiotic nutrition at the Cushy Institute and spent years in a remote Ecuadorian village exploring the nutritional status of children and household environmental conditions and promoting sound nutritional and environmental practices. She also worked as a high school biology teacher and guide through the jungle. Dr. Kellis earned a Ph.D. in nutritional epidemiology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and her research explored the long-term impact of globalization on divergent dietary and physical activity patterns between Filipino mothers and children. Dr. Kellis has published several articles, as well as a book chapter, exploring deleterious dietary behavior patterns in developing and developed countries, and subsequent policy recommendations. She has assembled a team of expert faculty to deliver one of the only online graduate programs focused on whole food therapeutic nutrition for clinicians, and that is at New York Chiropractic College. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Anna.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Well, you have quite an astounding bio. It's amazing that you've done so many divergent things. What led you on this path of having such a deep interest in nutrition?
I think like most people, it's quite winding, actually. I started young. I think I was probably at the time one of the pickiest eaters as a child. My mother and most of the doctors that dealt with me had ever met. And turns out, I think later in my life, I've discovered why I was such a picky eater. But that was probably my original relationship with food. The less processed for me, the better. Anything that was mushy or overly cooked or overly processed, I had a difficult time with. But in high school, my father became very ill, and my family became macrobiotic. And that, I think, coupled with an experience I had as an undergrad at Binghamton University in New York, my first major course that turned me on to environmental studies was with a professor who opened his class with the documentary Diet for a New America. So I started, you know, raised as a vegetarian, then becoming macrobiotic, so very conscious of food and its effect on health, watching its impact on my father. And then, you know, as an undergraduate, seeing the relationship between food and quality of food and environmental sustainability and sustainable practices in agriculture through working with this particular professor, Dr. Andrews at Binghamton University. So I think that was sort of an initial step for me. And then I've had some struggles myself with health through dealing with celiacs and some pH imbalances, and that sort of brought home my focus on nutrition. So that's an origin that's not unlike many people are finding, I think, these days with some imbalances or gluten sensitivities or, you know, inability to digest dairy or a lot of conditions that are on the rise, partly due to a lot of environmental toxins that we're dealing with.
Well, see, you put a lot of things together right there, because as a clinician, I am certainly seeing many more people coming in with various kinds of odd symptoms, and when we suggest that they just stop eating wheat products for a week, they're quite amazed at how many of those things clear up.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not, I mean, it's a difficult, a difficult process, I think, working with patients, because our system is not designed right now to understand, I think, the science behind why that would be the case. But, I mean, there's multiple factors. There's the aspect, you know, as you say, which is what makes it complicated for people. There's the aspect of the gluten itself, or grains that are somewhat difficult to digest, and that causing a breakdown in the intestinal walls, which allows for absorption of larger chains of amino acids, which are the proteins, some of the toxins, and all of them work in concert then to cause irritation. So it's not just one piece of the puzzle that is causative. And I think that we have a system in our medical system that looks for one agent that drives it, and then we can give it a medicine that will cure it, quote unquote. But that's not how nutrition works. And so I think that people are often very surprised, because it seems simple, removing gluten, but there's quite a complex and intricate chemical and biochemical explanation for it. So absolutely, it's a joy to see people improve so quickly when you remove some simple things from their diet, even temporarily.
And as you said, it is a simple thing. Now, you obviously, we just read your bio, you are highly educated, you look into things deeply, and you won't just say things off the cuff without an awful lot of evidence-based research behind what you're discussing. And that's why, to me, it's a never-ending wonder about why conventional medicine finds these thoughts that you're discussing with us foreign, because they're not just conjecture. They are well proven in mainstream medical literature.
Yeah, I find, well, there's multiple layers to why that gap has not been bridged from research to clinical. I think, where to begin? I mean, if you look from a political standpoint, and again, these are things that I want to throw out to the listener. As a researcher, I don't really believe in black and whites. I don't believe, you know, that there is, our system is way too complicated to believe that it's just for political reasons, or it's just for, you know, insurance companies' influence, or pharmaceutical companies' influence, or, you know, because nutrition is complicated, or because it's not as fast acting as, say, a drug would seem. But if you look, you know, at each aspect of it and understand a little bit more for each one, what ends up happening, the result is that someone becomes a little bit more savvy and becomes a little bit more critical, and I think that that's our goal. So, again, going back, if you look at the politics and their influence on what message gets out, so say through the USDA, when we look at the food guide pyramid, the food guide pyramid right now, for example, has grains at the bottom of the pyramid. Is that what should be at the bottom of the pyramid?
Well,
is
let's
that what
just explain
shows?
To our listeners, Dr. Anna, because I know you can clearly visualize that symbol. So when it's at the base, that means it should be a large proportion of what we're eating.
Right, correct. So the base of the pyramid is the widest point of the pyramid, and as you go up through the pyramid, the width of each level becomes more narrow, which sort of implies that you should consume less as you go up the pyramid. So there are grains at the bottom, and then fruits and vegetables, and as you go up, meat and dairy is towards the top, and oils and sugars are at the very, very top. I definitely think that the top of the pyramid you know, those things should be consumed the least, if not not at all. But having grains be at the very bottom, we know in research when we want to fatten things up, animals up, for example, the things that we feed them are grains. When we want to put our animals, our cats and dogs on diets, we take them off grains completely. When you look at how to, even when you look, you know, at Socrates, Plotinus, Hippocrates. Huh. I've studied a little bit too much of Greek and Latin in the last couple of years, and I'm mixing everything up.
Well, that's a good thing, and you study a lot of things.
But Hippocrates, and you look at his medicine. His medicine was porridge, what grain they were eating. If you look at cancer patients, if you don't want them to lose weight, you know, getting them to eat their grains, that's a great way to get them to not lose weight. So there's that aspect of the sort of throwing our bodies into weight gain, this constant obesity spiral. But if you also look at inflammation, which is now recognized as sort of the root of a lot of chronic diseases, or at least
actually
part
all,
of the mechanism.
Just about all of them, truthfully, yeah.
Yep. Absolutely, absolutely. But there are multiple aspects that lead to inflammation, and inflammation is sort of an intrinsic component then leading to chronic disease. But a lot of that is an imbalance between omega-3 and omega-6 oils. Most people understand those as oils that our bodies cannot produce themselves, and they're crucial aspects of, you know, of our body's cell structure. So our cell membrane is composed a lot of the omega-3s and omega-6s. If we don't have them, then, you know, we start to have a breakdown of our body's immune system and cognitive function and muscle response, infinite number of things. But omega-6 leads to predominantly vasoconstriction, or constriction of the blood vessels, and omega-3 leads to vasodilation, so anti-inflammation of omega-3 and pro-inflammation is omega-6. But most grains are very high in omega-6, so if we're feeding our animals very high amounts of grain instead of grass, they now have excessive amounts of omega-6 instead of omega-3. So if you're looking at grass-fed beef, you have omega-6 to omega-3 ratio of 3 or 4 to 1. If you look at a grain-fed animal, it's 20 to 1. So we're in a very pro-inflammatory environment. That is very clear. And yet, the food guide pyramid has grain at the bottom of the pyramid. But if you look at the food industry, who makes the most money? You know, what are the companies that make the most money? Well, a lot of them are huge, big monocultures that own a lot of the grain production that goes to the animals or production of vegetable oils. And where does that money go? Well, some of it definitely goes to supporting our government, goes to supporting lobbyists. And so to some extent, it's understandable that we have a system, at least in our policies, that doesn't really want to step too heavily on the toes of, you know, the hand that feeds it, as it were. So it's somewhat understandable politically why our messages are convoluted, even through our policy and the institutions themselves that are intended to protect us. So that's one aspect. Another big aspect is that medical students are not trained as researchers. So how well do they understand the literature? There are many fabulous clinicians who train themselves, who understand that going to the literature itself is crucial. And then there are a lot of clinicians that they understand anatomy and physiology exceptionally well, and they understand their specialty very well. But as a researcher and as a teacher, I've found, and teacher of clinicians, I found that many of them are not highly trained on how to pick apart a scientific research and article and really understand its limitations and how to interpret it and how to extrapolate information and how to use it then in their clinical practice. The literature has, the research has a lot of this exploration into nutrition, but having that be able to be passed on to our clinicians who do not have any nutrition training or have very minimal nutrition training. Nutrition is starting to become something that's taught in medical schools, but very few and very few hours. And for many older clinicians, they had no formal nutrition training whatsoever. I still to this day have clinicians tell me that nutrition is not a hard science and has nothing to do with health, and they're quite adamant about it, not understanding that nutrition is a hard science heavily based on biochemistry. I think there's a lot of reasons why that transition has not been made. I think it's very important for people to understand, which means that, you know, needing to take their health into their own hands becomes very crucial.
That's a big part of it. And you mentioned that in that great discussion that you just gave, the fact that whoever is supposed to be regulating and watching over you, there's a lot of gaps there for various economic and political reasons, not necessarily linked to the best science about health.
Right.
So that's very, very true. And hopefully, since you're young, yay, that you will get more and more involved with developing policy. And I think that that can really create change in the long run. Because there's a real lack of ownership in terms of the gap between what we know scientifically and then the economic interests that exist. So that certainly
Absolutely.
Can be worked around in the future. Let's hope so.
Absolutely. And another thing, I mean, there are multiple things to consider, too. And again, I want to stress I've met some exquisite clinicians. I just came from the Integrative Health Conference, Symposium Conference in New York City, where there are, 1,000 plus clinicians who are definitely exploring nutrition as a modality of healing and health prevention of disease. It is definitely entering into the arena, which is wonderful. But what a lot of clinicians face, a problem that they face, one is not really understanding whole foods nutrition. There's still the use of supplementation a lot, and that's sort of another controversial issue in and of itself. But being able to cook the foods and practice what you preach makes a huge difference in whether or not you'll be able to influence the diets of your patients. But the other piece is the financial piece. A lot of clients that I see and patients that I see and students that I talk to who are going into the arena being clinicians, a lot of the issues that they deal with is, I can't afford buying organic. I can't afford to buy tons of greens and vegetables. And that's a big issue. There are some solutions. There are some things that are rising in the field, like community-supported agriculture. And I think that there are even possibilities of physicians working in consortiums or starting to work together to work with farms and get CSAs and get grants for CSAs for patients. CSAs in and of themselves are about half the cost. The vegetables end up being about half the cost that they would be if you were to buy them in a store. So there are options.
It's so true,
that
Dr. Anna, but
rising.
I get that. I get that daily from clients who tell me that they can't afford to eat better. However, really, that's a misbranded thought form in every way, because if you can't afford organic, but you make cabbage soup for your family, you could feed a family of six for about $2. So I think
Absolutely.
Some of it is that just people have lost the art of cooking. They think it's so hard and so much
Right.
easier to go to a fast food restaurant. And with just a minor bit of education, you can see that that's actually not the case. It's a vast cost savings on so many levels to eat healthy. But you're right that that does interfere with people's perception of their ability to eat healthy.
Right. Well, the question is, then, where does that education come from? I mean, people will tend to turn to their clinician first, and so then we need to train the clinicians, or clinicians need to seek training themselves of, how would you cook the cabbage soup? Well, if they haven't done it personally, it's very hard to hand out a recipe and say, do this. All of us are brilliant and savvy. You know, we can see through something that doesn't feel real. You know, so if a clinician hands something out but they've really never made it and they don't really like cabbage themselves, you're probably going to pick up on it as a patient.
So true.
And knowing little quirks or little tweaks of how to make it. I mean, having made cabbage soup, knowing you can't put huge chunks because that's kind of, you know, too strong a taste, too pungent for some people, but shredding it and sautéing it very, very quickly in water or a little coconut oil, and then putting it in soup and putting curry in it. There are tons of ways that you can flavor it, curry being a fabulous antioxidant and anti-inflammatory. There are ways that if you've practiced and filled with it yourself, you could inspire patients in ways that they might not have considered consuming it.
That's so true. So we have to take actually a little break right here, and we'll hear about other wonderful shows that are produced and aired and archived right here, as your show will be as well, Dr. Anna, right here on Progressive Radio Network. And when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation into more exotic areas, such as how did you wind up spending so much time in South America and your many projects there. So we'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
To PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove it. I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off your face. It happened to me. Listen to the Barry Farber Language Club for details. Wednesday mornings right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. beginning March 23rd.
With Sierra Club Radio. Tune in Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com to hear interviews with green authors, activists, politicians, celebrities, and more.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman. I invite you to join me every Monday at 2 p.m. to listen to What Women Must Know, a show with a purpose to empower women with truthful information and in-depth, honest, candid conversations regarding holistic solutions for their bodies, their hormones, and pertinent life issues. So that's 2 p.m. every Monday on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Once again, to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com. And we are here today with our guest, Dr. Anna Kellis. And Dr. Kellis has been sharing with us a lot of in-depth information. And one of her many roles, but a very important role for her at the moment, I am sure, is as director of the School of Applied Clinical Nutrition at New York Chiropractic College. And I do want to bring that up, Dr. Anna, because we have people listening who might be interested in getting that kind of degree.
Excellent. Yeah, the degree is a whole foods nutrition program focused on training existing clinicians, and we have some DC dual-enrolled students. We have some MDs in the program, acupuncture and oriental medicine clinicians and students. Sort of
and
very
let's
wide.
Let's not forget nurses and nurse practitioners.
Absolutely. There are several nurses. And, in fact, actually, right now we have several registered dietitians who are in the program who went through the traditional, conventional nutrition training and felt that there was a lack of whole foods nutrition focus, whole foods nutrition training, and nutrition for therapeutic use, and then are now going through our program. So there's a very diverse group of students, but it is intended to train clinicians. The program is a part-time program, so there's two courses per trimester for 2 years. And right now, it's an online program. We just launched that last year, which I'm very excited about. I come from sort of a high-tier, very competitive, traditional nutrition training background and research background, and came into this feeling like, you know, online that is inherently inferior to an on-ground situation, and have become conformed, or I think transformed in my opinion. Online is probably the closest type of training that I've seen to the old Socratic method that I've experienced. Very heavy discussion facilitated by the instructor, and a lot of assignments and activities and projects and videos and blogs that you can incorporate into the courses so that the students really run the experience in some respects through the discussion. So the intention is ultimately to help clinicians incorporate nutrition into their existing practices. So we've had the program maybe for 5 years at this point, and it's in its first year of the online.
Oh, that's an exciting opportunity for people who do want to get a deep basis in understanding nutrition. And you also did a wonderful roundup in how using the degree can be used to even get certified as a clinical nutrition in various states. So it's not only a wonderful basic education, it's an in-depth education, a clinical education, and probably the only program of its kind, as you said. So it's so great that you're making that available to so many people now, especially with it being online. It opens up the doors and gets rid of that whole locality-based limitations, which is a really big new select form. Now,
I think the most important part, though, is there is a lack of conversation between the different modalities of healing, MDs, DCs, acupuncturists, nurses, registered dietitians. So having a forum like nutrition, which really should be the basis of, as far as I'm concerned, of all healing modalities, and it is the one common language between all of them, it's exciting to see those diverse groups begin to build a common language. So,
yeah, I would say, and that's something we can work towards as well.
Absolutely.
Now, during your life path, which has been so varied, it took you to South America, where you actually spent significant amount of time. As we announced in your bio, you were a biology teacher there, as well as a guide through the jungle. Those are very interesting. And also working for the Yahana Foundation. So tell us about what brought you to South America and you know, what your experience there was about.
For me, I from high school and even earlier, really felt sense of ignorance, being isolated in the United States and not having a sense of how other people lived throughout the world. Felt a connection, understood that most of the things I was using were coming from other countries, food that I was eating coming from, you know, other cultures, and not having any sense of them personally was confusing for me. So as an undergraduate, I was drawn to do an international studies. I just wasn't sure exactly how I would fit it in. In my second year, I declared an environmental studies major and then added a biology double major. But my focus in environmental studies was tropical ecology, environmental studies, rounded focus. And in biology, my focus was more biochemistry and nutrition. And the two of them, to many people seem disconnected. And to me, they were very clearly intrinsically intertwined. And so I went into the study abroad office and found the School of International Training, which is one of the only international studies programs where students are deeply embedded in a culture and in the last month are sort of left to their own devices to work with an organization within the country that they've identified and doing an independent studies project. So that was my first sort of introduction to a foreign culture. And my independent studies project was working in a foundation that worked with local preschools, primary schools, in the poorest districts of the city and trying to help the children nutritionally. So there were some profound nutritional deficiencies. And then I followed that, getting a grant from the U.S. government to stay there and do continued nutrition research in a small village in the mountains. So I was there for about a year, and that my love of the country, and I ended up leading into 3 more years in the country.
Well, what were some of the specific nutritional deficiencies that you found? I mean, were these people eating a traditional diet?
Actually, sadly, no. In the city, they were deficient pretty much in everything. And actually, what was interesting, what I found in the first experience was more about the politics than it was about the nutrition itself, and more that, in the country at the time, a lot of the nonprofits and even for-profits and even government agencies, were very inefficient with their use of the money, as it were. And so there wasn't much that was being done with the children, except, for me, the observation that they were extremely malnourished, not only calorically, but micronutrient-wise. My experience in El Chota was more eye-opening because I was off on my own and I built a relationship with the women of the village and was able to do research there that I developed and found some very interesting things. It's an area where a lot of the environment has been destroyed by sugarcane production. A lot of the men are no longer living in the village full-time, and it's left to mostly, the women and very large families. The average number of children per household was 8. And they have small gardens, and they will produce fruits and vegetables in those gardens, and then they'll sell them in the village, in the city, in the nearest city, to buy white rice and fideos, which is a very low quality pasta, and some spices and some oil, sugar, what they considered staples. And their food then would consist of, a typical lunch would consist of, on the same plate, white rice, a little bit of potatoes, maybe about a tablespoon of shredded carrots and tomatoes, and maybe occasionally an egg on top of that, and on the side a bowl of soup, which was pretty much water with a red coloring, and then the very low quality pasta. So heavy starch and very, very low micronutrients, and often the vegetables were washed in the river. And the river is where everybody washes their dishes and washes their clothes and also goes to the bathroom. So my first time there, I ended up with 2 weeks of an amoeba infection from a couple bites of carrots, which is not uncommon. So diarrhea is very, very common among the children. You also see that community is predominantly black, and you would see a lot of children with blonde hair. Very typical sign of micronutrient deficiencies, severe micronutrient deficiencies. Mostly...
Really? Wait, that was very interesting. I never heard that. So in other words, in a person, an Afro-American person, then if they have blonde hair, it might be a sign of nutrient deficiency?
And you don't... I actually have never seen a case of it in the United States myself. But then I haven't spent a lot of my life at this point researching out in the field in the United States, and I'm sure there are cases of it. I know there are very poor areas of the United States, but it wasn't
uncommon.
Were there
access in the community you were in? Were there access to taking blood levels, or you just had to review the diet and come to your conclusions?
It was a small clinic taking, assessing blood, samples and getting micronutrient levels, is not something that they could afford. But that's actually a pretty common, documented, condition as a result of some micronutrient deficiencies. And I'm pretty sure that particular one is a result of vitamin A deficiency.
And we talk about that a lot, yeah, where they have premature blindness so often in these cultures.
Night blindness. So mostly micronutrient deficiencies. What we're seeing, though, in a lot of developing countries, which is was the focus of my research in grad school, is that there's a situation that's occurring, what we call this nutrition transition, and it's occurring simultaneously with a phenomenon called the epidemiologic transition that's occurring, again, simultaneously with the demographic transition. So all three of them are occurring sort of as countries become more developed and gross national product increases and per capita income increases. And this is, again, this is a national estimate, so this isn't necessarily an equal improvement in income across for all individuals. It's not egalitarian in that way. But as we see it on a country level, we start to see these transitions. We start to see decreases in fertility, decreases in child mortality, on that level, increase of quality of life to some extent, and increase in an aging population. So that's the demographic transition. The epidemiologic transition is a reduction in infectious disease with a concurrent shift towards chronic disease. And the nutrition transition is a sort of decrease in famine conditions transitioning through to from nutritional deficiencies to nutritional excess. And all three of those transitions in their extreme latter state, that's sort of what we would see in a developed country context.
How long does that take to happen? Like, if you see, very often they'll say that people have various disease rates and that they're linked to genetics. But then when we see this nutrition transition occur, we see pattern changes that probably cannot be really explained through genetics.
Well, I mean, the situation or the whole story of genetics has vastly changed in the last 10, 15, 20 years with our understanding of epigenetics, nutrigenomics, nutrigenetics, that the recognition that, yes, your genetics predisposes you to certain conditions, potentially, but it's really your environment that draws out what are expressed of those genes that you have. I mean, you know, with respect to eye color, you can't, if your mother eats a tremendous amount of tomatoes, you're not going to all of a sudden be brown-eyed instead of blue-eyed. I mean, so, you know, within reason, but with respect to obesity predisposition and chronic disease predisposition and mental, emotional conditions throughout a child's life and, you know, through adulthood, a lot of those behaviors and physical conditions that arise are recognized now to be a result of the interaction between the environment and genetic predisposition. So just to preface with that, I think sort of proving that point to some extent is the nutrition transition, which does happen very quickly and is linked pretty closely to changes in the globalization, modernization, urbanization, and changes in affluence in a particular area. And all of those are linked to switches from a plant-based diet, plant or vegetable sources of oil, consuming foods that are local, consuming foods that are endemic to the area, and the switch to the more staple foods, high amounts of oil, change to frying your foods, increase in processed foods and sugar consumption, and predominance of protein coming from meat sources, high-fat dairy sources. Those are the transitions that we see, and concurrent with those, we see very tightly a transition to more chronic disease. That can happen within a generation or two, depending on the rate of increase in urbanization and modernization.
So you're getting a trade-off, because you said you do see a decrease, perhaps, in infectious disease with cleaner water, but then an increase in chronic disease.
Well, cleaner water is some. Also, maybe higher access to health facilities, more income to reach those health facilities. Also, you know, there is a tremendous amount of physical burden when you are highly active. Everything requires energy. You do not have a stove. You don't have any active forms or passive forms of transportation. There's no labor-saving devices in the house, so everything takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so the only ways to reduce some of that, you know, for example, is not boiling all your water, or not going to find the cleanest water, or not activities like that might lead to a reduction in infectious disease. You have all of those things happening, so a tremendous burden on the body, and then susceptibility to the infections or infectious agents that you have in those areas. So with urbanization and modernization, you do have sort of a reduction in the excessive energy burden on the body, and you do have some labor-saving devices, and you do have access to some health. And so, yes, some of those things do lead to a reduction in infectious disease in some areas more than others, absolutely. But, you know, where's the happy medium is sort of the question.
That's a good question. That's exactly a good question, because there's a double-edged sword, as you said. So perhaps we
absolutely
can take the best and leave the rest,
right,
as we move forward, try to get more of a balance instead of this swing.
Right. But it's a tricky situation, very political again, because, well, look what we've done with our own environment, and look at what we've done with our own country. And because of our experience and because of our research and because of, you know, what we've learned, you know, we now recognize that, oh, transitioning to total passive forms of transportation and transitioning to excessive use of labor-saving devices in the house, it may be not a good thing. But how can you tell another country, you can't do what we did because it'll be unhealthy for you? As countries gain, you know, disposable income and individuals gain disposable income, there is a trend to, you know, mimicking what's happening in these developed countries that are all glamorized and, you know, shown on the TV that now are being highly imported into, you know, homes that can now afford them. So it's a real tricky situation as a researcher and as an interventionist. What do you do? How would you intervene? Education is certainly important. I think maybe going in and building community gardens, you know, helping purification techniques with of the water. But education is crucial so that people actually see what they have, the value of what they have may actually be better than what we have. So understanding the value of what you have, I think, is crucial.
Now, community gardens is a big thing, especially when we go back into politics, that a lot of the food safety legislation that's being passed seems like it will make it more difficult, actually, to deliver food that was grown in community gardens because of the cost of a lot of these licensing requirements.
Absolutely, in the United States.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it's very, very unfortunate. I'm not quite sure what the solution for that is in the United States. It seems to me blatantly politically driven. You know, it's very easy to say for insurance reasons we can't do this, but you know, I find it very difficult when I look at some of the medicines that we use that for insurance reasons are the fallback or default choices that the medical institution has, and you look at the research and how intense the side effects are, or how actually little we understand about them and the long-term consequences, and really how well they work to begin with. You know, I look at those things and I say, well, they're covered by insurance, but you know, community gardens are somehow going to threaten us. How? So, you know, I think that it's important for our listeners and for everyone to be asking those questions. I wish everybody could read the literature to see how not black and white our understanding is of pharmaceuticals. I think that would be wonderful to begin that debate, you know, so we say, well, okay, how bad is this? But I think what's the most important thing is for people to consider is, you know, when we look at drugs and when they enter into approval, one of the things we consider is it safe, or how long can we continue to consume this before it causes harm? You know, we sort of look at how the cost-benefit analysis, I guess, and I look at the food and the community gardens, and I wonder, you know, what's the cost-benefit analysis with this? How much good and how much harm could it actually cause?
Yeah,
you know, in comparison to how many people die after open-heart surgery. Well, how many people would die by being a participant of a community garden?
That's great. Perhaps we can put a research project together about that, because actually with community gardens and CSAs that I'm involved with, we have trouble donating the food to food banks for these reasons. And, you know, there just seems to be so many issues that come between people just eating good, simple food, both due to, like you said, lack of knowledge and seemingly working against that concept in terms of industrialization. So there's a lot of issues here, and perhaps getting more back to the basics is the best way to go. It would save people money, make good food more accessible, make it easier to distribute to those people who really need it, and just a lot of common sense moves.
And I think it's a matter of, you know, for people who really want to get the food to the people who need it, it's simply a matter of being one step ahead of the industrial mechanism, you know, and and staying creative. You know, so if you know you can't deliver food via an institution, then how do you educate people, individuals and families, so that you can reach them directly? Can you deliver to a stand that is centrally located, and then families can you know, obtain the food that way? Then you're not delivering it via, you know, some institution like a food bank or a school, or any institution that receives government money. I mean, it is a matter of becoming very, very creative, building co-ops, building communities. So it's driven by the individuals and not driven by an institution. It seems to be sort of the direction we need to go in.
Yes, and there's a lot of things we can do outside of trying to change the legislative process, as you said. Tell us a little bit more about your understanding of CSAs.
Well, community supported agriculture is a mechanism for farms to secure their harvest or the purchasing of their harvest. So before a season starts, they will put out the call for, you know, people to buy shares of the harvest of that year. And it's a way to ensure that, you know, they know that the food that they will be putting so much work into will actually be bought, because it's already been paid for before the harvests or even the production seasons. So it's a way of supporting your farms, and then there's multiple benefits. And one, you can become a member of a farm that you really care about, builds a personal connection between farmers and individuals again, something that we had, you know, for hundreds of years and in the last 100 years have really lost. So that's a beautiful connection. And then also, you know, you can pick your farm based on what you like. So every farm has their own way of doing things. Some farms you can, they'll, you know, put their, harvest, they'll pick what goes in a box and then they will create a share and you buy a share. Some of the farms, you go to the farm and you can pick and choose what you want to go in your share, and you can have a unlimited you pick at the farm. So it depends on sort of the personality of the farm. But that is something that has been profoundly lost in, you know, this huge supermarket conglomerate. The other thing is people think that it's just vegetables. There are bean CSAs and bread CSAs and dairy CSAs and meat CSAs. And a lot of times the farms will actually build relationships. So, for example, a farm that I was a member in this last winter, they have a relationship with the farm next door that has a meat CSA. And they have in that CSA, you know, depending on the month, they have different meats, poultry, dairy, I think it's a pound of cheese, and then a dozen eggs per month.
Well, so believe it or not, we are running out of time, and you had such a tremendous amount of information. I want to thank you so much for being
Absolutely.
Our guest. And those of Absolutely. You who have been listening, we have been listening to Dr. Anna Kellis, and she also can be found at A. Kellis, K-E-L-L-E-S, at nycc.edu, and that's New York Chiropractic College, which is the home of the Masters in Clinical Nutrition that Dr. Kellis is the director of. And the show, as well as the contact information, will be posted on the archives right here at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Just look for The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.